Howdy, this is Ian. Just letting you know there may be a few audio issues right at the end of it. We're hoping that it will be mostly listenable. Bear with us. We'll be back to speed next week. On with the show. Howdy, and welcome to the 3-2 Outcomes podcast presented by Baseball Prospectus. I'm your host, Ian Lefkowitz, and joining me, as always, from Suburban Michigan, it is Ben Murphy. Ben, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, Ian. How are you?
I am delighted. I am delighted to be recording our first podcast this week. Certainly not. Nothing lost to the annals of history. So everything went well. No problems. Great. Joining me, as always, from our nation's capital, it is Jared West. Jared, how are you?
I have a sore throat, so if I'm even less intelligible than before, I apologize.
That is tragedy. Just as tragic as, let's say, the entire program Skype crashing. Not our Skype. Skype, the concept, crashed.
I think it's the Skype servers, right?
Yeah.
Jared, is it possible that the weight of your beard is weighing down your like vocal cords? And if you like groomed it a little bit, you might be able to speak better?
I don't think that's how that works.
I'm married to a doctor. I think that's how that works.
So you say like anyone with a beard just can't talk? Is that your
It's premise? Not that they can't talk. It's that when the beard is larger than their face, it might cause some strain on their vocal cords.
I mean, I'd like to see some evidence for this. Then.
To be fair, I
have N of one.
I did see that on YouTube. Straight down the jet fuel can't melt steel beams. From there, but you know, obviously the beer germ theory really solid evidence for that one. All right, we are happy to be here. We may have started another podcast earlier this week. Thank you for bearing with us. We were talking about Manny Machado at the time, and we were very excited that he had signed and something had happened. Now it is 2 days later. We've already used all our thunder and we are less excited. How do we feel about Manny Machado signing with the San Diego Padres? Jared, I leave it to you as our Manny Machado expert.
It's old news. Manny who? I mean, that was days ago. Who even cares anymore?
I was so excited for the city of San Diego, and now because again the most exciting thing to happen to San Diego, still in history, I've looked up since then. San Diego was like I think it was what Veronica Mars started filming. I guess before that it was San Diego was founded. And those are really the major highlights so far. I guess Comic-Con is in there somewhere, like the first Comic-Con.
You know, I'm going to assume you didn't know I was born in San Diego.
Oh, yes, I did. I totally did.
Well, all right.
I sent your theory to a Padres fan, Ian, and they came back with, what about the 98 World Series? And I was like, no, I think this is still more exciting. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I do like, as you know, trolling major American cities. It is one of my favorite hobbies. And I feel like San Diego doesn't get enough trolling against it. Because it's like pleasant. And, you know, as a New Yorker who, you know, may have heard one or two people insult New York in their lifetime. I just feel like San Diego deserves a little bit more edge on the stick, if you know what I mean. You know, it's a nice place, but I feel like this is really going to liven things up. You know, it has been 50 dullish years, and I am kind of delighted to see the Padres moving forward. This is almost as good as them switching back to Brown and Mustard, but
not quite. I understand.
Not quite. Yeah. Seeing Manny Machado in Brown and Mustard next year is really just going to be the single highlight of my season. any other thoughts on this? I think when we were recording on Tuesday, we thought, this is going to mean that the off season begins. And since then it has been 2 days and, the biggest player to have signed is like Fernando Abad. It's been a rough 2 days. So, you know, I do think at some point everyone's going to have to sign, right?
You'd think so.
Yeah. It is interesting. And again, I'm going to talk about this as though we hadn't belabored the point last time. It is interesting. Like, it does feel like this is just going to be the way it happens now, right? Where, you know, the incentives are for teams to sign players later and later. And it does really bring it does present a challenge for Scoresheet and for like every fantasy baseball product as to how to kind of render that. You know, right now, Manny Machado is already an NL crossover for this year. Mm. But, you know, it was interesting. Like, what if Manny Machado ended up signing with, say, the White Sox, again, to pull a team from the ether? Could have been any team that came to mind.
I would have never guessed that was the team you were going to suggest.
Yeah, I mean, no, I mean, he certainly had no reason to sign with the White Sox, you know, such as friends, family, the presence of his, like, high school coach, anything like that. You know, again, just, like, completely random. Brother-in-law, whatever. You know, if he did that, like, it would be so interesting because you would have Manny Machado as an NL crossover for this year because of the 3 months he spent with the Los Angeles Dodgers.
Yeah.
And he would spend 17 years in the American League projected and just be a crossover for 10 of them, which feels insane.
Yeah. No, I mean, I agree.
Can you think of a way, is there a way around it? Like how, like, I guess, how do you think, what do you think would be the best way to handle this?
Well, I mean, I sort of think that the problem is that, in especially for something like Scoresheet with a lot of public leagues, you have to set the date at some point. At some point, you have to have a cutoff so that leagues can start drafting. And it has to be prior to the season, right? So I think they're sort of in a pickle. I don't know what they can do necessarily.
Yeah.
It seems like there is some flexibility where they could push the date a little bit later. I don't know that that would have – I mean, that might have helped in this case, but obviously, like, Harper's still unsigned.
Yeah, I mean, a little, but there's only so much in you. At some point, you have to start drafting. And there's no real incentive for players to sign with a team any earlier.
Yeah, and it's tricky. Like, if teams are going to start going past the start of spring training and to sign significant players, you know, there are some – I feel like there's just going to be some damage to the model, really. And, you know, I – like – obviously, I think Scoresheet is in a bind. I don't think they're alone. And there's just, especially for like public leagues, I don't know that there's that much we can do about it. It's just like something to keep in mind that maybe a couple of starters are just going to be missing for a season. Or
it's
not available.
Just starters in this case, right? It's like top 10 players.
Yeah. Right. Or just placed into a league randomly in hope that that's the one that's appropriate.
Yeah, because I think it's better to have him in than not having him in. That seems right. Worse.
Right. But, right, having Dallas Keuchel in the AL doesn't – like, if he's not an AL player this year, it probably doesn't matter because everyone would keep him as this crossover. But it probably doesn't feel great, I guess.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, like we had been talking about before, it's not that it's unique to Scoresheet, but Scoresheet has more AL and only leagues than – other kind of roto places.
Yeah.
Is my impression, at least.
And it's tricky. Like, the big solution is, like, the toughest to implement, which is, you know, the custom player pool. But that's just really a long walk away from where we are. So, you know, I think right now it's sort of a rock and a hard place, and hopefully the next CBA after, you know, the great strike of 2021 will hopefully resolve some of this perverse incentive to sign later and later into the year.
We can dream. I don't know, though. I don't know that there's much anyone has much of a desire to get rid of that, though.
I think so. This was the thing that was most interesting to me about the delays in some of these big free agent signing was how many players were being outspoken and how direct they were in their outspokenness about how things are set up now and like the consequences of that setup. I think there are a couple of situations where players were talking about, you know, having paid their dues, so to speak, in the like pre-arb and then arbitration years, basically like the first six, the like rookie contract or whatever you want to call it. And they're like, you know, the expectation is that free agents would get paid. And then other people, of course, were firing back. They're like, you know, why aren't minor leaguers ever included when you're thinking about the,
right.
You know, the financial viability of playing baseball and the idea that like the baseball players deserve to make some kind of share of the revenue commensurate with their participation. And obviously there's way more minor leaguers than major leaguers. And, you know, I think there's probably way more room for the quality of life to improve for minor leaguers before they feel like they're being adequately compensated. But it seems like if there's going to be a huge shift in the next CBA negotiations and the way that it's set up, it's going to require that they acknowledge that minor league players aren't really being treated very well. And I think historically the reason it's been that way is because of their representation in the MLBPA is basically zilch, right?
Yeah. Well, and their exploitation makes their,
benefits know, everybody relative else.
Power. Right. It benefits the owners at the expense of, major league, because it creates this value sink where, you know, a player's like salary does not match the economic value they provide to a team.
Right.
Where, you know, what was interesting is you had Rob Manfred talk, say, a couple days ago, you know, that he refuses or he doesn't believe that payroll and winning are correlated.
Yeah, I think what he said was he doesn't believe that a team's payroll is indicative of how hard they're trying to win or something.
Right. How hard,
which is even more, which is even more absurd on its face than
right.
What you were saying, like whether they're correlated or not has to do with like how competent the front office is. But like the payroll is a direct reflection of the intention of the front office. Right.
Right. Like if it's not correlate or if it's not a reflection of how hard you're trying to win, then that's terrible.
And what's the point of some of these luxury caps and stuff like that?
Then, yeah, the economic model of your game is broken. So, you know, a lot of fun coming up in baseball. Maybe, you know, a score sheet will be, you know, we could just run those off-season leagues.
Yeah.
Historically. I always wanted to play that nice 68 season.
I was going to say, this comment more than others, but maybe, like, just especially this comment by Manfred, I appreciate that you brought it up because it reminds me that like some of the things that he says, I'm like, are you insulting our intelligence or are you really that like clueless? You know, like, like does he actually believe that or does he expect that we will actually believe that because he says it? Now, of course, he's not like the only person in a position of power that says things that are sort of antithetical to reality, but I don't know. I just don't really think he's doing a good job.
No, Commissioner Trial Balloon is not my favorite person in Major League Baseball. You know, there was this interesting thing where like, he came aboard and it was like, oh, well, he's not Bud Selig, therefore he's good. And it turns out that those two things might not be true. Or may not, like, in a relative sense, or was it that he was hired right around the same time as Adam Silver, and I think Adam Silver has made a bunch of really progressive changes to a progressive league and has been thoughtful about stuff, you know, despite being a tool of the owners, whatever. But
well, so every commissioner is going to be a tool of the owners. That part of it, I don't hold against.
Right, them. which is fine. It's the job.
Adam Silver's just not a doofus about it.
Right, but I think there was this thought, like, oh, look at this old guard of commissioner. Leaving and then the new blood is coming in and Manfred and Silver and they're changing things and it's like, oh no, those two people are not the same. Like one of them is just having a 4-year conversation about whether to instill a pitch clock Like, they're just
not to defend Manfred, because I don't want to be in that position, but I think it's a little different because Silver at least has the players who are tend to be progressive pushing on him. There's an influence there. Even if he doesn't directly report to them, there's still this loud media presence for them, whereas baseball's super conservative all around everywhere.
Yeah, and I actually wasn't referring to like Savitz's case. I was referring more to like economic factors and things like this, you know, the kind of how to structure the league. And it doesn't feel like any of his arguments are in good faith.
Sure.
which I guess makes sense, because he was the one crafting all the Budsy League for a decade anyway. So there you go. All right. On that really positive note. I swear the podcast on Tuesday was much less dispiriting, you guys.
The only thing I remember saying on Tuesday that I haven't said so far is that I think the Machado deal is probably one that both sides can be happy with. Right? Like, Machado shouldn't feel like he settled for too much, too little, and the Padres probably won't feel like they paid too much. I remember we also talked about some of the things that people had said about some of the long-term deals and how they had been, the sort of narrative around long-term deals is that they never work out, and people cite things like A-Rod's deal, and it's like, well, the like story that gets told about some of those doesn't necessarily reflect, I think, what we were saying is our perception of the reality of those deals. And I know that there was a discussion, Jared, I think you had mentioned that you had with somebody at work, and I don't know that we need to get into the details about any of those or try to rehash what we talked about on the podcast, but I do think it's worth mentioning at least that, like, this is exactly the kind of player you want to give this kind of deal to, you know, young, prime, strong defensive and offensive value, great clubhouse guy.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah.
I think he is a great clubhouse guy.
Yeah, I actually don't hear, I've never heard anyone criticize him, like, on his team. Just, like, literally everybody else who plays against him and is around him for more than a few minutes.
So I've played sports, and I think on most of the sports teams I've been on, there's always, like, that one a-hole that's on your team, but, like, they're your a-hole. Maybe it's like that. It's like, yeah, like, we know that guy's kind of a jerk, but, like, we like him, so we're going to make excuses for him.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's like that for Machado or not, but I've played Frisbee with people like that for sure.
that sounds right to me. You know, it's interesting, like, the you know, for Bryce Harper, it was like, well, he's only had one great season, and, you know, is it actually true that he is you know, worth that contract? Is he going to stay healthy? You know, and there was all this dithering about, like, how he's not going to be worth $300 million, and with Manny Machado, it's like, no, we think he's worth that. He's just kind of a dillweed. Is that really gonna, like, drop his value? Like, it was just that, like, oh, well, you know, that doesn't actually matter.
The consensus at this point is that Harper's going to get more, right?
Yeah.
That's a consensus, I'd say. It's not unanimous.
Yeah. Okay.
My suspicion, and I, you know, there's a chance he'll sign by tomorrow if we don't hear about this, that he'll get more, and he'll get more monetary value, and some of it will be deferred so that everyone can pretend they won.
Yeah.
So, looking forward to that. In the meantime, did we get some questions?
We sure did.
Okay, I have to turn it over to the mailbag captain now.
All right.
Before we sail this ship too far.
And as a friendly reminder, you can always send your questions to scoresheet@baseballperspectives.com. Our first question comes from John, who's asking about the difference between BP's depth charts and value in score sheet. And so John calls out Omar Narváez, who has a 28.8 SSM, but is at -0.4 on the BP death charts. So he's asking, is it because of defensive metrics, or why would somebody get a different value in terms of SSM versus, say, WARP or whatever you might be finding on BP death charts? And I think you guys had some answers there.
Yeah. Ian, do you want to go first? Or you want me to go first?
You should take it as the. One of the founders of SSM.
No, I mean, no. Nate Silver created SSM way back in the day. I just helped renovate it a little bit. So Yeah, that figure, that negative 0.4 figure that's cited in the question is the warp projection from the depth charts. So there's one quick semantic thing I want to clarify is that the depth charts help drive the playing time projections. And so any projection on BP's site that needs playing time as part of it, or like would have playing time baked into it, is going to be influenced by the depth charts. So that includes both the warp projection and the SSM projection. The warp is listed on the depth charts, but the SSM is generally not. You can find the SSM on like the Draft Aid or some of the other fantasy specific tools. And especially for catchers, the defense is going to be factored completely different between SSM and warp. And in score sheet, catcher defense is not really going to have much of an impact. So in this specific example, the SSM is going to be basically just offensive value, and there's a little bit more consideration in SSM given to how well a player does relative to average, not just how well they do relative to replacement level. Most of the on-field metrics like warp or vorp or something like that are based off of a specific replacement level, and SSM includes some calculation about how that person will do offensively relative to average. They're also using different replacement levels. In terms of catchers, it's probably moderately close, but especially for corner infielders and DHs in BLs, the replacement level is like a little bit higher in score sheet than in the real major leagues. basically because every team in a 2014 BL needs a first baseman, a third baseman, and a DH. And obviously in the majors, there aren't 24 DHs that are playing on a regular basis. So there's this sort of weird, like, upside-down replacement level thing around DHs and first basemen and, you know, other sorts of folks that might play DH. The only other thing that I think is worth keeping in mind is that SSM is designed to reflect what the player's contribution will be in score sheet. So it's not going to be park adjusted, basically, or it's going to take the park adjustments out of the other metrics. So something like warp is meant to measure how well a player will do in a neutral park, and SSM is going to give extra value to guys that are hitting in Coors, or, you know, dent a pitcher a little bit more if they're pitching in Coors, and accordingly on down through the other park factors. I think that's everything.
Yeah, and just for those who are unfamiliar with SSM, which I assume most people are coming to us through Baseball Prospectus and are at least somewhat familiar with the concept of SSM, but it's a kind of single number value that's score sheet specific, right? So it helps you line up players, perhaps while you're in your draft. And I do think it is, if you care about score sheet, I do think it's a good reason to subscribe to Baseball Prospectus. You know, I do think it has more relevance than, you know, war warp, because it kind of it reflects reality less, right? And it reflects the game more. But, you know, one thing to keep in mind is just that I would say SSM is a, like, it's like a static number. So, you know, and your draft is dynamic. So just keep that in mind. And also to keep the real world in mind, because Omar Narvaez is, if he's actually below replacement level, is in danger of being replaced, either as the starter or perhaps on the roster. So just because a player has a lot of at-bats projected, you know, I think having a low warp might also lead to some unforeseen circumstances.
Yeah, I think a bunch of the other fantasy tools also would be helpful. I mentioned the Draft Aid, and thanks for the context on SSM, Ian. I probably should have done a little bit more there, but if you haven't already checked out the fantasy offerings there, I think Rob and the team have done a really great job of bolstering up, you know, all of the different things that are available to subscribers, including the SSM stuff that we mentioned, but then also Team Tracker, which helps you roster all your players and hooks directly into the score sheet roster, so you can very easily import your score sheet teams into Team Tracker and then look at how they'll how well they've done over the last week or the last month or year to date or what have you. Makes it a little bit easier to look at how you want to put together your lineup card and stuff like that, and gives you a pretty handy way to incorporate all the other BP fantasy tools.
Yeah, I genuinely think it's a very good tool for score sheet players, and would recommend it if you are into that sort of thing. And I assume most of you already use those tools. All right, anything else?
Yeah, and so I'll ask the question again. I think we all agree that SSM is probably the best metric to use. I suppose one could argue that we're biased. We probably are, but it's also the only metric that's specifically designed for score sheets. It's got that in its favor.
And it's not without its faults, right? Like, it could be improved. I wouldn't want to say that. Yeah.
Sure. But let's say you're in a league where everybody else uses SSM because it's a super awesome league. What is the next thing you'd go to if you want a second opinion? Would you go to a win-based metric like Warp or War? Would you go to, a roto draft, average draft position? What would be the second thing you guys would go to?
For me, I would say maybe even more than Warp or War, which again, I look at for like playing time and concerns like that. But I would probably look at a value metric overall. So, something like wins, WRC plus, or, another measure of a player's like offensive contribution, just to kind of get a sense of, what their per game value is, and then kind of track that against what their placement on the roster is, and try to do that ourselves. I feel like the advantage to SSM is that it kind of does both steps for you, but it kind of also helps to understand the components that go into the steps.
I also don't remember the name of the part. I guess it's part of the draft aid or something, where Rob actually posted some of the components of SSM that are used that you can look at, which is probably helpful. And again, like, part of the reason that SSM takes into those things, the rate or quality rate at which like a player is going to produce, and also the quantity and like the number of plate appearances, is because it's hooked into the depth charts. So it's taking advantage of the playing time projections and, the like research that the BP staff has done on what the likely roster is going to look like for the major league teams. So.
Yep. Yeah. We're cool. not paid to endorse, just fans. Yeah.
Well, I mean, back in the day I had a hand in trying to make it as good as it could be. So. But that's been years ago now.
All right. Okay. What's up next?
So next is a question from Brad, and I think this is where Skype conked out on us last time, so I'm really scared to ask the question. But Brad's in a Dynasty League. It's not a Score Sheet League. It doesn't appear to be a Score Sheet League, but it's similar enough, except that they get to keep 20 out of their 27 players on the roster each year. They get to keep them forever.
So many players.
15 prospects they get to keep, which is not part of that 27.
Oh, my gosh.
It's a lot. So this is my understanding of what a Dynasty League tends to be. It tends to keep virtually your whole roster, if not your whole roster.
Does the same team win every year?
I mean, I guess it depends. I don't know. I'm about to join one of these in football, and I think it's a little different in football because there's more
variables. Dude, you got to stop playing fantasy football.
It's kind of the worst, yeah.
Boycott the NFL.
Anyway, Brad's question is, he wants to know if he should trade Chris Sale, AJ Puck, and Brendan the Braj Rogers for Manny Machado. And I won't go through his whole team, but he's got a pretty good team. That's a pretty good team.
He sent this question in before Machado signed, right?
Yes, the question came in before Machado signed. Although as far as everyone was listening, knew.
No. Yeah.
But yeah, I guess Keenan said, would that affect your opinion of the deal, or...
It's not a great place for Manny Machado to sign. I think not like in a fantasy perspective, just not only is he going to a park that's, while not as much of a pitcher's park as it used to be, is still, at least neutral to below. And he's probably not going to be a shortstop. And I think there were a few circumstances where he could have been. But, you know, I think Manny Machado is a pretty strong player anywhere. Bold stances. Enjoy those hot takes.
So I think you had talked about the value consolidation here. And I think, you know, some of the risk tied up in Sale and maybe some of the risk that Puck or Rogers don't really meet their full potential. I think we're generally in favor of the Machado side of this deal. Is that true?
For me, I would actually go back and forth on it. And a lot of it is a referendum on Brendan Rogers, who is, as I see it, a fairly controversial prospect. But, you know, I think as long as he is in Colorado, is somebody of interest. You know, I don't think he'll match Machado, but I do think Chris Sale is, you know, the best pitcher in baseball, or the second best pitcher in baseball at worst. And I don't know that Manny Machado is the second best hitter in baseball. It's tempting. And like, I do understand get the best player. And Manny Machado, I think, is the less risky side. I might actually go for the bigger platter in this case.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I'm still on the Machado side, but I could see that.
I think this offer reminds me of some advice I got at one point that is worth reiterating here, that like, if you're getting ready to try to propose a trade and you don't hesitate a second before you click the like propose button or send on the email, then the trade's probably not balanced enough. I think like this trade is something that you could advocate both sides for pretty readily, as we have just demonstrated, but also is like a good opportunity to point out that part of what makes it interesting is that it is pretty balanced, and it's exactly the kind of trade that is likely to generate a good discussion in the league when it's actually offered. And there are way too many trades you get where it's offensive, I guess, or, you know, sort of insulting.
If you are risk averse, I would probably take the Machado side. So we would probably take the Machado side, all done, all told. But, you know, I definitely understand there's a lot more variability in Sale, Puck, and Rogers, but I think it's a pretty stout upside. Sure. And even the 75 percentile, it's just, you know, a few definitely solid players there for me. All right. Anything cool. else?
No.
That's good.
Okay.
All right. We plucked a couple of questions from Scorsese Talk. The first one was about a 10-team and only league. It's a keeper league. And the person was asking about their 13th keeper. Mm-hmm. So I won't read off their whole team, but their 13th keeper that they were trying to decide between was included Maeda, Kingham, Suzuki, Josh Bell, Scott Kingery, Adam Eaton, or trading a pick for Tommy Pham. And I know, Ian, you had some thoughts here.
Yeah. So among the players who are kept, you know, I think I would go with Kenta Maeda, who is a very tricky player, I think, for score sheet, and has like deceptively little value at times. Or I would say he like, because he's a player who will get you to the playoffs, but I think the Dodgers have now shown two seasons in a row that by September they prefer to move him into a bullpen position in order to get him ready for the playoffs. And I suspect that would happen again, which kind of obviously tanks his value in the score sheet playoffs. So it's tricky, but I don't, nobody else stands out to me there. So I would say maybe Josh Bell. I think Adam Eaton actually has, maybe Adam Eaton actually is the strongest player. It's a little risky, but I think he has, I think when healthy, he might have the most talent of anybody. All that's to say, yeah, trade your 29th round pick for Tommy Pham. For God's sake, you know, so just to for those who weren't like paying complete attention to Tommy Pham last year, essentially what happened to Tommy Pham, he came in April, destroyed the baseball as he did through all of 2017, you know, crushed the baseball, then got hurt, which is part of the Tommy Pham story for sure. Then got in trouble for calling his idiot manager an idiot. Then got benched. Then got exiled. Then went to Tampa Bay. And then started crushing the ball again. Like, I think at this point he has a two-season history of pretty much crushing the ball. He's an older player. He's an oft-injured player. There is risk. But I think he stands out among this crowd by miles. How does that sound?
That sounds good.
All right.
You're not going to make the pun you always make?
No, I remain as a big fan.
There we go.
I don't understand why you laugh at that, Jay. I guess it's my fault for suggesting it.
You did suggest, but like, you
well, I waited until I thought it was over, and I was hoping, like everything else, that by calling it out, I would have ruined the joke, but...
I mean, because it's like fan, but it's fam.
Thanks. Like, yeah. Yeah. It makes it funnier when you explain it.
I thought so.
That's what everybody tells me.
I thought you were hoping, like, Ian closed with Miles. I couldn't tell if you wanted, like, a Miles Mikolas joke or.
I wish everybody could see the groan on Ian's face as we just run roughshod over his joke.
Got him. All right. So the last thing that we plugged from Scoresheet Talk, and this is maybe a week and a half old at this point, was about, and it goes back to draft aid. Someone was asking why the unsigned players weren't showing up in draft aid in the depth charts from BP. And I think we had some thoughts there.
Yeah,
and this is back to like when Harper and Harper's still not there, but Machado too.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the mid-tier unsigned player, and there are obviously a lot of players who are on teams right now who don't have numbers because a lot of players have their numbers called between seasons, which we have experienced as well.
There's players that are like actively rostered on Scoresheet teams that Scoresheet doesn't give Scoresheet numbers to.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, again, not to beat a dead horse, but we have a podcast, so that's really what our... Yeah, we'll beat dead horses. I'll say it. you know, I think when you're talking about keeping your ID system, that's fine, you know, and I think there are some advantages to it. It's like homespun. I like when player with the most innings is number one as well. I get it. But, you know, just to know there are consequences, and this is exactly one of the consequences that we were talking about, that it breaks draft aid. And if people are trying to build things, the product won't work. And, you know, maybe that's fine. But, you know, there are people who are unhappy. So just to be aware that you know, we're not bringing this up just because we really enjoy database architecture. It's because we like building things and because we like, you know, we like to make things that work easily and that help people.
It's also possible that some of the unsigned players aren't showing up because on the BP side, the draft date doesn't have them projected for playing time because they don't have a team that they're going to play for yet. So like, you know, Harper probably will have a good SSM projection, but he's not incorporated into the depth charts yet because we don't know where he's going to play, which is a totally separate issue from the ID thing, but might also impact your consumption of some of the data that we're talking about.
Yeah, and I think that's a good note for BP as well. And I think I've heard Rob talk about that in particular. You know, I think in an ideal world, it would be good to have a neutral part protection for players like that, but that's just my own opinion and, you know, maybe difficult to present elsewhere.
I think,
and just to be clear, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was gonna say, I think that there's, we can look it up, but I think there's somewhere on the BP site that includes like the non-playing time adjusted version of the projection.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not tied into most of the fantasy stuff because that's not what people want to consume when they're looking at fantasy stuff. So like when it comes to Pacotas or something like that, there's some like baseline Pacota that's agnostic of playing time.
Yeah, I mean, I guess what it comes down to is like if you really want to excel at the draft, you have to look at everybody and you have to do the work yourself. there's no system that's going to solve everything for you. You have to know the players and you have to be able to make decisions.
Yeah, and I was just going to say, it's not a BP-specific thing, just to steer away from that a little bit, that if anybody wanted to build a tool to plug in the score sheet stuff, they can have the same sort of problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. We've seen it. We've seen it with the independent sheet. It's not just us either. Based off that, it's going to have a problem. So, yeah. Okay. Not to go too far down that rabbit hole once again, but there we are.
Feeling it won't be the last time.
All right. Anything else?
Well, we did have a question about Joey Gallo, but it wasn't set into scoresheet at baseballperspectives.com, so I don't feel great about talking about it.
Okay. We like Joey Gallo. How's that? this Three Trout Comes Baseball Podcast. Yeah, we like Joey Gallo.
We can also respond to the email. Jared's giving a hard time because the person emailed me directly instead of the podcasting.
Wait, did I not make it clear? Scoresheet at baseballperspectives.com.
The bigger problem here is that I don't follow baseball, so I'm not the person to email. I do check my email compulsively, so I made sure that the smart people saw the email and that we would talk about it.
Yeah. So in that sense, you are the right person to email.
Fair enough.
But scoresheet at baseballperspectives.com.
Yep, that's just an email. I think we had a couple of things we wanted to talk about. I'll give you a lead into one and the other. I absolutely refused to do so.
Okay.
Mike Moustakas signed with the Brewers, and I think they're talking about playing him at second. And not that we want to rehash the whole positional rating battle thing again.
Yes.
But
yeah, but we do, because this is the podcast where we beat dead horses, right?
Yes, let's do it.
This is my favorite Ian rant.
Yeah, well... I just think, again, this is like instructive to see the way baseball is being played in 2019, where they look at Mike Moustakas and say, oh, you know, we're going to draft, we're going to sign him, a player who we had last year, to play second base, a position that he has never played in his entire life. Now, what do you think his range rating is going to be?
Average.
Yeah. In real life, once he
Sorry. Yeah. What? Clarify what you mean.
So in real life, it is going to be his range rating is going to be probably fine, probably a little below average.
Sure.
Similar to third, but in score sheet life, it's going to be a disaster unless he plays second base for the first week of the season, in which case it'll be below average because I think his third base rating is a little below average. I should have checked that before. And you know, it's just. It's interesting because I do feel like somebody on the Brewers is able to adequately simulate and project what Mike Moustakas would be like playing second base.
Probably with some of that StatCast data, right?
Yeah. And I realize they have access to a ton of stuff that we don't, but it's also clear that those decisions can be made. And yeah. I don't know if it's this year or 10 years from now or somehow, but it's an interesting way to go as to think of as an endpoint to kind of understand that.
And if it weren't Moustakas, but it was some prospect that was coming up that hadn't played second base or like wasn't rated there yet, wouldn't the score sheet range rating be like positional average?
Yes.
For that person?
Yeah. Yes.
Even if they were a butcher or whatever, right? Or fantastic, right. As the case may be.
Right, where you have occasionally this arbitrage where you know, like center field prospects are always a little overrated because they come up and for the first year they're not really strong defensively and they can't hit enough to play the corner. And really terrible defensive players are always a little underrated because they can come up and, you know, you get probably a full year of like average range out of them.
Good times.
So, yeah. Okay. That's well, join us next week where we repeat the same thing.
And I think it's worth harping on just because it's, and there's no system that's going to be perfect. I think we all
right
there, but I think that it's a relatively simple fix here to make things better.
Yeah, or even just to think about like what we want out of a sim, which I think is what we've been trying to steer this conversation towards a little more.
Hmm.
But even if the answer to what we want out of a sim is some more intricate system, the infrastructure that exists could very easily be used to have something that better fits how baseball is being played, which is that like you could have range ratings for other players at positions that they're not used to playing and just have it be abysmally low for the players that you know would play abysmal defense at those places and have it be reasonably below average for some of the other ones.
Right? Yeah, or like, ask your... Yeah.
There's that full spreadsheet that they published that has a column for every range rating for every position and a row for every player. And if you really wanted to, you could fill out a range rating for every position, every player at every position.
Right. And it could be 2.45 at third base.
Right.
And then you just deal with the consequence.
Right.
Or
2.0 in the outfield or whatever. Right.
Yeah. I don't think we are necessarily suggesting that players should be more defensively versatile than they were before. Just it should, you know, are there better ways to sim reality, I guess?
Yeah. I think the major complaint is that major league teams are more often moving players around, right? Like the Cubs do this all the time, but like moving players around on the diamond and saying, yeah, we know that he's not going to be a great left fielder and we're okay with the consequences of his terrible fielding because it allows us to get his bat in the lineup. And it would be great for score sheet owners to have that same option and say, yeah, he's going to be a butcher in the outfield, and that's okay. We're going to take that hit because that's the strategic trade-off that we want to make.
Yeah, or it's even more so because he's not playing in real life. And, you know, I think there are ways in which, you know, playing players out of position that they aren't playing in real life is just less fun. You know, so I do hear that. But. You know, just balancing the consequences appropriately seems like a better way to treat that.
Cool.
Yeah.
I think I'm looking through the rundown and that is everything that I am seeing.
So I had an article that I thought was interesting from this week's for this week's Baseball Perspectives. I just wanted to bring it up.
Are you sure?
Yeah, well, it was fun for me because, you know, Pakoda came out and, you know, there are a couple fan bases who are a little mad. And strangely, they are the two fan bases I most enjoy trolling in life. So, yeah, so I thought, why not? So number one, Joe Matt and like, why is Theo Epstein like, how does he know how many games Pakoda was over or was under on the Cubs? Like, like, don't you have better, like, you have better things to do. You have an actual team to run. You don't need to be doing this. You don't need to be
grudges to hold Ian.
Oh my God. It's
don't
like
begrudge the man his grudges.
It's incredible because my mid thirties, I grew up my whole life without the Cubs having won a World Series, like most of you. And it just takes 5 years, three years for them to get this petty again. Like, did you really think when you were like, and I know we have some Cub fans who are listening, like, did you think like, oh my God, when it was 1999, it's like my parents, my great grandparents have never seen the Cubs win a World Series. And, you know, I just want one before I die. And like 3 years later, you'd be like, this baseball projection system doesn't believe in us. Even though other popular ones kind of do. Like, I don't know, guys. So meanwhile, Aaron Grilleman wrote that I found fascinating about some of the worst.
I needed some work, I thought.
Some of the worst teams in Pecota's history. Pecota created in 2003. And the 2003 Tigers were projected to, that year, right? Were projected to be, 59 and, was it 59 wins?
I think that's
59 and 1-3. And, you know, that was early in the system, and, you know, the Tigers were legitimately terrible, and that record has not been touched since until this year, when a spunky team managed to overcome the odds of regression to the mean. The positive odds that pull you towards a better place. And posit the worst Pecota in baseball history. Jared, how does it feel to be a fan of said team?
Well, first, I gotta say, it feels good to be number one. And second, yes. As an O's fan, Pecota has misjudged us from the start. Back when we were making the playoffs, O's were making the playoffs, Pecota had their team had like, I don't know what it was, 70 wins, whatever. So I have no faith in Pecota. I think it's complete garbage. It has no idea what it's talking about.
Jared has been hired to write the Orioles media notes.
You have to make sure he knows what a database is first. Jared, are you going to make any Matt Wieters jokes in your marketing materials about Pecota?
No, I think they were right on Matt Wieters.
Yeah, they nailed that one. Everything else was a little off. Yeah, that's all I had. Just a little mild trolling. The Orioles are terrible. I cannot wait.
So bad.
Couldn't have happened to a better guy.
Baseball is starting tomorrow. And okay, so like I think I made this rant, but pitchers and catchers reporting is not a date that matters. No one should care that pitchers and catchers are reporting. That is like the least important date of the offseason. Because you can't see them. Tomorrow is the important day, or actually today. So this is Thursday, and Friday is the real important day, which is the first day that spring training games are available on MLB TV. That is when the season begins. That's when I can start watching baseball games, and then I can stop in late October, maybe November if I want to tape some AFL games, maybe December if I want to start practice my Spanish. I don't know. Life gets strange around then. But like, yeah, the first day of spring training. This is so I am about as pumped as I can be for baseball at any given time. And I think the best story of the season is how dismal the Orioles are. This is just like historically terrible team. And I'm so looking forward to this, because I feel like this is the relationship that we met each other in the early 2000s. No, this is really Larry Bigby's year. And yeah, like, like maybe Jay Gibbons is our all-star. So like, to get back to that dynamic is just something that I've been waiting for so long. And
waiting
to have lost that for this decade has been really strange for me and difficult. So I'm just, it's just thrilling.
Happy it worked out for you.
Yeah, I look forward to coming back to that next season. So in addition to that, you know, we talked a lot about baseball, and I think we've said once or twice that we do want to cover a couple non-baseball topics, make this more conversational. If you were here for the baseball, you can tune out.
It's fantasy baseball related, right? It's not like... Wait, what are you getting ready to segue?
Oh, I'm getting ready to segue to the wrong item.
That's true. Segue.
No, we should segue to the right item, too, our actual item.
I mean, we can skip it also. I don't care. I was caught off guard. As much as I'm prepared for anything, I was like, oh, this is a thing I can talk about. And then you're going to skip it.
I'll warm up again. Don't worry. Okay. So next on our rundown, which we actually do have, you know, semi-professional, we did want to talk a little bit about the concept of a salary league, which is exciting to us because we are kind of in the first week of our own salary league. NL Who's the Boss shouts. where we spend a lot of time putting together a spreadsheet to help us track a kind of salaries outside of the score sheet system, and to turn what could, you know, the draft into something more of an auction format. And I think we just wanted to start the conversation, which I think we intend to have throughout the season, of what that feels like, you know, what we think a good salary league would be, and, you know, maybe get some feedback on, you know, what you guys would want to see as well. So I think just to start, throw it out there, are there things that you like or don't like about being in the salary league? And Jared, feel free to offer
you. He's only getting something.
Oh, Ben, yeah, sure.
No, Jared, you can go first. It's fine. I'll talk forever in a random wandering tangent.
Well, I mean, the appeal has always been that you have a shot at every player in a way that you don't draft. To me, that's always the nice thing about salary auction, whatever, that the ability to, I mean, obviously at some point you run out of money and that's fine, but at least at the start, you have an ability to get any player you want. I don't know, that's always been appealing to me.
Well, and that flexibility gives you, like, the individual player flexibility gives you complete roster construction flexibility too, where you can sort of build the roster how you want. And I think having an overall salary cap or what have you is a more interesting constraint than having just a set number of draft picks. I think that part of it is that intrigue or complexity is part of what's compelling to us, because it's a different sort of problem solving, right? And I think that's part of what intrigues other owners also. The flip side of that, of course, is that it requires a little bit more work to track all that stuff and make sure that everybody understands it and have enough rules in place that there aren't too many unintended consequences or weird. Like, you don't want any loopholes in how rosters can be constructed or something like that that would sort of break it.
Yeah, one more point on threat too is just, so in terms of, I think in terms of like valuing players, so like we talked about Mike Trout a lot on the podcast before, and it reduces some of the transaction costs. So in a normal league, yeah, you can trade Mike Trout if someone else values him more, but there's transaction costs associated with that. In a salary kind of league, it's more granular than just pick number one versus pick number two. You can assign a dollar value to that. And I think that it allows for, I mean, accuracy is the wrong word, but allows people to get players closer to the value at which they value them, and reduces the transaction costs in doing so.
Yeah, and it actually makes leagues feel a little more liquid, I think, at least the one we're in.
Yeah, there's more flexibility in how trades can be set up, so more trades happen, right? Like, Mike Trout is almost never going to be traded in a normal score sheet league. But, if this were an AL league, like, he might be traded because he's going to have a salary that's commensurate with his value, and there might be other assets that have salaries that are maybe a little bit lower than what their value would be. A contending team is going to want to pick up Mike Trout for that playoff push, and he's going to get moved. There's players at the top end of the salary levels every year that are basically on a one-year deal every year, and the teams that are trying to contend will bid into the, like, so the overall salary cap is $100 million in this league, who's the boss. And so, like, every year there's a handful of players that go for over $20 million, like an individual player taking up, you know, almost a quarter of one team's salary. But those players end up getting traded a lot of times, or some of the players, like, in the middle tiers, because they can help the contenders, and you know, the salary does a good job of capturing their overall value in a way that you would never see in a normal league. You'd never see players like Joey Votto getting traded, 3 out of 5 years or something like that.
Yeah. So, right. Exactly. And I think we may want to get more into the weeds in future podcasts about some of the mechanics of, like, how we'd want to create that. But, you know, overall, I think there are some good pros and cons. Do you Do you think there's like a certain personality of the league that makes a salary league work? Like, you know, how would you know that a salary league is right for your for moving that way?
I think it'd be really tough to take an existing league and turn it into a salary league, but you could take an existing set of owners. I mean, some of them are going to be the same as any other league, right? Having like some comfort and familiarity with each other so that there's more trade conversations and stuff like that. And I think having some variety in player valuation perspectives and strategies helps also. You know, if everybody's using the same single metric to value all the players, then things get a little bit more stagnant because there's just sort of a general consensus that happens and then there's not as much movement.
See also baseball.
Especially more and more recently, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, 5-10 years ago, that wasn't the case.
I think it also requires generally active owners, maybe a little bit more so than another league, because if the market gets a little bit skewed, if, you know, some people run out of money and then other people have tons left, but they aren't, you know, applying the appropriate bids or whatever. So I think it works a lot better if you have generally active owners.
Yeah. And maybe that is worth getting into a little bit because, you know, I think a lot of people have experience with auction leagues in fantasy format. Our auction league is a little unique. And I think some of the challenge with moving to an auction format for Scoresheet is just the sheer amount of players who are drafted in a Scoresheet league or who are needed in a Scoresheet league that, you know, I think you could possibly try a traditional auction format, but you have to have people with a lot of patience in order to make that work. I think, you know, that's several nights of drafting at least.
Yeah. Figuring out a good way to get all the players auctioned without starting in December is definitely a part of it. So our league does it in like batches, and basically you can nominate, I think it's 8 the first one and it's 8 the second one also. And then it goes down to like 5 or 3 towards the end, but essentially like the first couple of rounds have way more players nominated at higher dollar values. And then it sort of scales down towards the end.
I want to say it's almost like a hybrid silent auction format, if that makes sense.
We don't have to get into the details of the auction format itself. That wasn't my intent. I was just saying like there's also an additional administrative overhead, right? It's not just the time that it takes to have all the owners involved, and it's not just that you need all of the owners to be more involved, especially in the preseason, because there's no like draft queue that you can set and forget like there would be with the standard league online draft tool. But it's also additional work to have somebody keeping track of how the different bids need to be resolved and making sure you're keeping track of once the players have their salaries and, you know, especially if you're going to have like extended contracts and stuff like that. We basically have like a whole spreadsheet infrastructure that we've set up to try to make that as easy as possible and streamlined as possible. But even still, it takes several hours every year to make sure everything's set up and ready to go.
Yeah. And, you know, something I think we'd like to hear from y'all about and something I think we'll be thinking of, like what would be the best way to represent this in the future. And I think we may have some of those conversations on air in some weeks ahead and, you know, maybe come up with an exciting format. But, you know, I'd like to hear about people's experience with, I guess, non-standard leagues, and not just non-standard in terms of number of keepers, but are there like unusual auctions and other formats going on? And, you know, feel free to drop us a line, scoresheet at baseballperspectives.com, and we'll, we'd be interested in talking about that kind of thing.
Yeah, I dare say that the quirkiest non-standard leagues will get mentioned on air if that's something that appeals to anybody. So send us your fun, crazy league setups.
So anything else you wanted to cover in this topic?
No, I think we'll touch more on it later.
All right. So, you know, as I was saying very casually and naturally, we spent You know, we wanted to touch on some non-baseball topics in addition to baseball, and especially since baseball hasn't started yet, there's, you know, a lot of free time. So again, if you're listening to baseball, if you're listening for the baseball content, now you can turn the podcast off. But you probably turned it off before because you were like, really? The people who are only listening for the baseball content are, I would say, at once sharper than the rest of us. And since everyone here is here for the nonsense, I can include you. Sure, you know, they are both sharper than you. But also, the thing they don't realize is that our baseball content is not very good. They are like, they're like really efficient, but wasting a lot of time. So it's just it's a real dilemma for those people. But you know, we wanted to occasionally bring up some important life topics. This one came up in my life, recently, where I had a moment of clarity and, perhaps realization. And I do want to bring this to everybody's attention and kind of bat it back and forth. And essentially, what I want to say is, with a lot of preamble, because this is hard for me, I'm not a crackpot, but soup is a pointless meal.
I don't understand this. You think you know somebody.
Yeah. Okay, so hear me out. I'm not saying soup is bad.
Okay.
Soup can be good. Soup can be fine. Soup is usually fine, just to be clear. Soup can be good. Soup can occasionally be great. Soup is never better than the thing that you could be making from the same ingredients that doesn't involve putting boiled flavored water on top of said ingredients. Soup is never improved. No one is like, I want to drink my dinner. Like, if you have a jaw injury, like, people are like, I am very sad for you. You're right. This came about the old, let's say, Boff Mary Kill game that I was discussing with a friend, and it was a soup salad sandwich, as you do.
Wait, what do you call it?
Yeah, what she was. Yeah, well, you know, I don't want to explicit tech. Well, you feel free to go nuts. Okay. What she was saying is that, obviously you kill the salad. And I was like, no, like, salad is fine. Like, you can have good salads, you can have great salads. They're hearty, they're interesting, be complex.
Soup is hearty way more often than salad is hearty.
Most of them are boring, but that's fine.
Mostly rabbit food is the problem.
Right. But soup. You have soup, and then you're like, oh, that was great. I want to eat a thing now.
Okay, so hang on.
Yeah.
And this is going to get into that other stupid college debate. Like,
now I'm going to take some questions.
Is chili a soup?
Okay, so, right. So they're like the soup semanticists. Like, is cereal a soup? I don't care about... No, because if you said, I want a soup, please, and someone handed you cereal, you would smash it out of their hands.
Okay, is gazpacho a soup?
Is gazpacho? Yeah, because it's
okay, so what's the difference between gazpacho and cereal?
There's a difference there.
I mean, I feel like you've been having gazpacho. But
ingredients are different. I mean, like, in terms of your soup semantics, what is it that makes gazpacho a soup but cereal not?
Because gazpacho is a thing I can order from a place that serves soup.
That's like begging the question.
No, I'm a descriptivist. So, you know, it's like, it's soup because it's called a soup. Cereal is not a soup. Anyway, that's beside the point. Cereal is fine.
Is chili a soup?
Chili can be a soup, but the soupier the chili is, the worse the chili is.
Yeah, but... chili is very hearty, so if your whole like agenda is about how soups aren't hearty or are pointless, then I think you have to categorize chili as not a soup, otherwise you're going to lose this argument real fast.
No, I mean, you take the liquid out of it, right? The more liquid you drain out, the more, less it is soup like. Like a stew is better than a soup. So because again, like it has ramen. More actual food.
Is ramen a soup?
Okay, so this is where something like ramen. Yeah, ramen's a soup, but ramen is fine.
No, 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 no. You live in New York. You have to have had good ramen. You can't say ramen is fine.
I have had great ramen. I have had ramen from best ramen places in New York City.
Okay, and it's just fine?
It's fine. It's like, it's okay. It's good. I wish it wasn't a soup.
But it's not like it's losing anything from having the flavor of the soup. You can still eat the noodles if you want to eat the noodles without the soup.
And I do.
So what's the... it's like the best of both worlds. I know yeah. Jared's going to bring up other noodle soups also, right?
Sure. Like, right, a bad world with soup and a better world without. Yeah. Go ahead.
I think I reject the premise entirely. Like, I don't think soup replaces a meal. I don't think anyone views soup as a meal replacement other than my dad. He's weird. But
some people do eat soup instead of having a meal.
I understand it's done, but I don't. Yes, fine. Right. Like, if I needed meals only and I had to choose between soup, salad, and sandwich, yeah, I'd probably get rid of soup. But that's not why you want to have
salad way before soup. Salad is just anyway.
Yeah. I mean, there are ways to make salad good, though.
But yeah. Soup is almost always good without having to like come up with a contrived way to make it less like something that gets eaten in the wilderness. Like,
you don't convince me of the merits of soup. I'm on your side here.
You said you would get rid of soup instead of salad, though.
Yeah, if I had to like just because I could, if I can only eat things for meals.
Okay, we agree that like sandwiches is number one, right?
Yeah.
Okay, mm-hmm. So you're saying you would have salads ahead of soup?
In terms of like, if I had to have it as a meal, I've had salads as meals. They're fine. They get the job done for a little bit of time. Soup, it's harder. I mean, you'd have to have like pho and ramen, and then otherwise you have.
So
like
what do you put on your salad? You're saying like any old salad with iceberg lettuce gets the job done? No, you have to have like actual food on the salad so that it doesn't consist of just water.
Well, I don't go with iceberg lettuce.
Right, because if it consisted of just water, you know what it would be? Soup.
No, because there's other stuff in the soup.
This is the point. You hide the water.
I think there's like substantial. Like,
I feel strong. I feel stronger about this than ever. This is only convinced me that I'm right.
What about like crepe soup, Ian? Chicken noodle soup? Like crepe or chicken
they're good. Noodle? I mean, like, I'm not
it's
saying
weird
right
to
again.
Hear
it's
Ian
not that,
be so wrong about something.
It's not that soup is bad. You know, there it can be fine. But you know what else is good? Crepe.
Sure.
You don't need to drown it.
Yeah.
I think if you guys like as an appetizer, I think if you use soup as an appetizer rather than as a main course, I think that's what you need to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I have had soup. I will have soup again in my life. It just does not seem like a thing I need to like choose.
So what meal would you make with the ingredients for ramen that isn't ramen and is better than ramen?
I don't know. I'm not David Chang.
But the whole premise of your thing is that like the soup is never the best option.
You'd probably just say like a pasta dish or something.
Yeah. Yeah, I would go.
That's exactly right. What the soup is plus the broth. Oh, that's a terrible argument.
Yeah, broth is delicious and nutritious.
No, because makes you feel well, because you go to Momofuku and then they say, I had the ramen. It's good. It's good. It's very good ramen. Had a great time. The cold noodles are where it's at. It just gets right to the point. You don't need hot, again, you don't need hot flavored water. It does not improve the situation.
When you're sick, don't you want soup?
We'll cross that bridge when we come to it.
This is a crazy thing. I think
all right. It's fine, Jared. Well, he can't be right about everything.
Clearly.
Again, listeners, feel free to weigh in. I think I feel like I've made a strong case.
Well, that... I know you feel like you've made a strong case.
Yeah, there's nothing strong about your case except for that you want to change the semantics to fit your definition so that you can be a little bit less crazy.
It feels bulletproof to me. I don't know what you're talking about. So
this is what you guys must feel like when I talk about baseball.
Well, I'm proud of myself. What's the best thing you saw this week?
I don't even know anymore. It might be that slime video you showed me on YouTube. I mean, so hang on. Obviously, it's like 100% something my daughter did, but I don't have like a good way to show you or anything like that. Every day is great. And nobody wants to hear me just say my daughter over and over and over again. We might need to post a link to this slime video that you sent, because this was not something that I knew existed, but it seems like something I need in my life. And I'm a 35-year-old, you know, father now. It's got this glorious, like, very gratifying consistency to it, and you can put all kinds of shimmery glitter and colorful stuff in it to make it really fun to look at.
Sure, and just to add some context to this conversation.
I don't see why any context is needed.
No, which I agree with both of you. It stands on its own. But
you asked me what was the best thing I saw this week.
No,
that was the context. This is random-ass YouTube video that you sent me about slime.
Yeah. So having met and talked to many Scoresheet veterans, I know your demographic. So there's a chance you might need to there's a chance you might not have heard about slime videos is what I'm saying. So you know, if you ask, let's say, hey, what are the kids up to these days?
You have to be careful about how you describe kids, though, because you're talking about like actual children here. You're not talking about like college kids. You're talking about like middle schoolers.
Right. I guess that's part of the Scorsese generation. Yes. Actual kids.
Yes. Children. What are children doing after 2 p.m. Or whatever?
Yeah, they are right. Your middle schoolers are, and many of your parents and have experiences, are getting home, firing up the old YouTube, and just watching people like play with slime and like crunch things and brush things and do makeup tutorials and open boxes, which is, I will just say this, as somebody who has always been a fan of existentialist filmmaking, I feel like I have a lot of faith in our young generation. Because I feel like anyone under the age of like 18, like plot no longer matters. Character no longer matters. And it's just sound. It's the only thing left. We have just stripped everything else out of the art of filmmaking. And I could not be more here for it.
I don't think you can call this stuff on YouTube filmmaking.
just wait until next year's Oscars, where they replace best short animated film with like best slime video.
The other thing about this, I don't feel like the word slime is accurate enough. I think there needs to be a different word for it, because it's not actually slimy. It's quite dry.
Mm-hmm.
It's more like gunk or goop or gack or flubber or something.
Yeah, I think we called it gack back in the Nickelodeon days.
Yeah.
I would agree. It doesn't, if you are kind of unfamiliar with the concept and trying to picture it in your head, it would not be what I would think of as slime, the classic, like, you can't do that on television.
Right.
Style. Right.
Yeah, if that's what you're thinking of, it's not that at all.
It's not the slime of our generation, that's for sure.
If somebody tried to drop it on your head, it would just kind of sit there and you would pull it off your head, and it's more like a stress ball that's very squishy.
Yes, and can make apparently the most relaxing videos ever and turn 12-year-olds into millionaires, because you know that's the country we live in.
Well, I think you're conflating a little bit the sensory videos with the slime videos, because my impression is that the slime videos are just about like how you make the slime, and then like the beauty of the slime is the like making it yourself and like squeezing it or whatever.
I think
sensory videos are like actually something where people are going to YouTube for the explicit purpose of like listening to somebody crunch honeycomb or whatever the heck it was.
Absolutely. Well, slime, I think, has two purposes. One is like looking at the slime, and two is like, you know, as people manipulate it. So okay. It's just multi-sensory. Again, really good art. Looking forward to, you know, Truffaut's slime, the revival, playing at Film Forum next week. It's gonna be great. Jared, do you want to see Aaron Sorkin direct a slime video?
Oh my god! Do I ever?
I feel like this is where we are heading as a society, and I just want to get out in front of it. You know, this is the equivalent of getting busy living. So yeah, now that we've been that topic, I guess I'll go next because I have an actual thing to recommend. This isn't actually a bit. I just watched Russian Doll like everybody else this weekend.
I haven't seen it yet. Don't spoil it.
I don't think I could possibly do it. It's one of the best shows I've seen in a very long time of show watching. It is highly recommended. And I have heard this now from a couple people. My mother actually texted me because I did recommend it to her. After she texted me yesterday, like there was a snow day at her work, and she was like, we're just gonna sit home and watch an episode. And it's like 3.5 hours later, it's like, oh, we just watched literally everything. And yeah, it is completely compelling and just an incredible story about I would say like actually makes me think about the concept of recovery, the concept of addiction, the concept of therapy in a new way. New York in the 90s, I think the has a lot to do with the character of the Lower East Side, and I think Tompkins Square Park plays a role, which, if you know My Secret Identity, is kind of hilarious. That, you know, I just can't recommend it highly enough. And because of the show that it is, I can say nothing more about it except to say that you should probably see it. It has actually like helped me, and maybe we'll do so for you as well.
Wow,
but I doubt it. Jared, what is the best thing you saw this week?
Man, I'm gonna top that. So I was at a bachelor party this weekend.
Congrats.
Yeah, thank you. Not mine.
Congrats then.
Yeah, I was gonna say congrats to Jared's friend.
Two side points to that. One, bachelor parties, at least I found bachelor parties in my 30s are a lot different than bachelor parties.
Wait, is everybody else that you're with also in their 30s? Because I feel like that could make
a difference. Yeah, no, everyone was between, or almost everyone was between, say, 33 and 36.
Usually. Okay.
I think Saturday night we were all in bed before midnight.
Nice. Yeah. Of course.
We went
stupid late.
We were in Memphis. We went to the Civil Rights Museum on Sunday, which, I mean, yeah. I've been to, and whatever. My own thoughts of the Civil Rights Museum, but it's not exactly what you expect for like a bachelor party kind of weekend.
It's true.
Yeah. But it is a legitimately great museum. One of the best. You disagree?
Disagree. Okay. I don't think it's a good museum. I think, obviously, the topic's important. I don't want to be arguing that, but I think as a museum, I have some issues.
Oh, that's interesting. Maybe I'm thinking of a different Civil Rights Museum. I dragged Civil Rights store across New York, because I've always been in my 30s, metaphorically,
even when I'm older.
Yeah, maybe I'm thinking of the one in Atlanta, but go ahead.
We can save that for a different.
Yeah.
The second side thing is that you really learn a lot about a person, I think, in a bachelor party weekend. Like, you can tell just spending a couple of days with them and how they act at the bachelor party. You learn a lot about a person, is something I found, both good and bad. But the reason why it was the best thing I saw, there's something, at least in my experience, about a bachelor party. In this case, there was 9 guys, so 8 guys plus the guys getting married. And it's just a bunch of guys, and it's usually at least multiple cliques, so 2 or 3 groups of people who kind of maybe know each other, but maybe don't. But everyone just sort of gets together and is like, you know what, this weekend we're going to just deal with it and hang out with our friend and make sure he has a great weekend. And it's just like a bunch of guys as a posse being like, hey, you know what? Like, we're going to support this guy and make sure whatever he wants to do, even if it's not something that I particularly want to do, or if I've done before, it's not my bag, whatever, I'm going to make sure he has a good weekend. And the fact that, like, you know, eight guys can get together and, you know, six of us can all be cramped into like one living room on six different sofas and beds and stuff and one bathroom, and just like, you know what, like, whatever, we're just going to deal with it and make sure he has a good time. And we did. And I don't know, there's something kind of affirming about that, that, you know, it's like, hey, we're going to support this guy. So I don't know. I like that. I like the camaraderie, the spirit of it.
Wow. That's, we got really sincere at the end.
The bigger surprise is that I had nothing to do with it, I think.
Yeah, I should have left the Oriole content. Drop that now. But no, I think that's the spirit of human interaction is really good. And then that
you do.
Yeah. Really, really give that a try sometime. All right.
Jared, well, that's a good your friends straight on gender norms, stereotypes, and all those other things we've been talking about.
Ooh, I missed that, was it?
Never mind. I was joking. I said, did you set all your friends straight on gender normative stereotypes and all those other things that we've been talking about? That's the real value of the bachelor party, is to infiltrate everybody else's toxic masculinity and change their minds about sharing their emotions.
I also realize that most of the bachelor parties I have been to have been co-ed in my life, which is... Yeah, it's definitely which different. Is why I like my friends. So, you know, we're there. I don't get bachelor party world at all. So I am all for hitting civil rights museums. This sounds great. And you know, and getting to know each other and understand each other.
Well, I mean, like, there's different forms of bachelor parties, like, yeah, you know, like, and there's masculinity without toxic masculinity. Like, we were out drinking on Beale Street one night, but we didn't go crazy. And yeah, we made our friend drink like this really blue drink because we thought it'd be funny if he was drinking it. But like, you know, we were playing games at the table, like just like, I mean, essentially board games we were playing at the table. Like, you know.
And to clarify, was it funny?
It was hilarious because the drink was terrible. It was mostly because the drink was terrible.
Yeah.
That's too bad.
All right. Memphis. Memphis, it's no San Diego.
Yeah.
That's a tagline. All right. Just lost all of our San Diego listeners, including Ben. It's really awful. Okay. On that note, San Diego, have a brighter tomorrow. On behalf of Ben Murphy and Jared Weiss, I'm Ian Lefkowitz. Thanks again, and have a great day.